Before you go any further with this episode, I want you to download the free app, Photocast, and listen to this episode there. Photocast is a podcast player, but what sets it apart from regular podcast players is that they provide deeper digital stories. For example, you could be listening to this episode of Morbidology on Photocast and immerse yourself in some bonus content, such as photographs related to the case, including photographs of the victim and photographs of the criminal investigation, as well as links to newspaper articles and much more. As you listen, the bonus content appears at the appropriate time in the episode, so you could be listening about certain evidence and see it on the screen as you listen. On Photocast, not only can you listen to your favourite podcast, but those episodes can come alive with supplemental digital content paired with that episode. With Photocast, everything you want to know about that specific episode is right there on your fingertips. I know for me personally, when I finish an episode, I'll always go and Google image the people involved and read more about the case. But with Photocast, you don't need to do that. So click the link in my show notes or just search for Photocast on the App Store and check it out. Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. In September of 2009, police in North Naples, Florida, conducted a welfare check on the DeMas family after they hadn't been seen for several days. When police entered the home, they immediately noticed blood pooling in front of a closed door underneath the stairs. They would be met by a particularly gruesome scene, which spanned several rooms inside the home. The grim discovery would be referred to as the most horrific and violent event the community had ever experienced, and the responding officers would require extensive counseling in the aftermath. It was the 19th of September, 2009, when police in North Naples, Florida, were alerted to the home of 32-year-old Gerlene Damas, who lived in a gated community in Hampton Circle, North Naples. A family member had become concerned for the well-being of Gerlene when she hadn't been heard from for around 2 days. They had become increasingly worried about Gerlene when they found out that she had not shown up for work at a local Publix. When police arrived at the home and knocked on the front door, they received no response. They received a key, and when they entered the home, they were met by an unexpected and tragic scene. Inside, the home was eerily quiet. They immediately noticed that there was blood pooling in front of a closed door underneath a stairwell. When they opened the door, they found the body of Gerlene. She had been bound with a white extension cord, and her head was covered by a black plastic bag. They proceeded throughout the house. In an upstairs bedroom, they found the body of 9-year-old Mitchsack, face down on a blood-soaked mattress. In another bedroom, they found the bloody bodies of 6-year-old Marvin, 5-year-old Maven, 3-year-old Megan, and 11-month-old Morgan. All 6 victims' throats had been slit, and they had sustained numerous stab wounds. Gerlene's husband, Misak Damas, who was the father of all 5 of the children, was nowhere to be found. Collier County Sheriff Kevin Rambosk immediately stated that Misak was a person of interest in the murders. Masak's car had been discovered at the airport in Miami, around 120 miles away from the family's home. He additionally stated that they believed that Masak had left on a flight to Haiti shortly before 10 a.m., just the day before the bodies were discovered. According to Sheriff Rambosk, a process was in place to work with authorities in Haiti to track Masak down so that he could be questioned in relation to the murders. He stressed that Masak wasn't a suspect, but instead was a person of interest. Jean Dumas Sr., Masak's father, informed investigators working on the case that his son certainly was in Haiti. He said that his son had called his brother from there. Jean also stated that he believed his son very likely could have been the person who killed his family, stating that he was a very jealous man and had believed that Garlene had been cheating on him. He also said that if his son was guilty of the murders, then he deserved to die in the electric chair, stating, "Because I believe in justice, God gives people the authority to do that." He said he believed that evil factored into the murders, before saying that he could speak no longer. Investigators were in the process of trying to establish some kind of time frame for the murders. Jean said that he last saw his son on Tuesday morning, when he brought the children over while he performed community service. Masak had worked as a cook at Miller's Ale House in Naples. He had left his shift like normal on Thursday night. The children had attended school on the Thursday, but they were noticeably absent on the Friday. Then when Garlene didn't show up to work on Friday, the store contacted her sister, who was an employee at another Publix, and asked her to contact Masak. When her sister called Masak, he said that Garlene was sick and was on her way to the hospital. The murders were particularly gruesome and really disturbed the community and surrounding area. Sheriff Rambosk called a press conference.
Every homicide is tragic. However, this is the worst of the worst. That in no uncertain terms, this is the most horrific and violent event this community has ever experienced.
Friends, Garlene's brother, said that the family were trying to comprehend what had happened, stating, "It's very tough to figure out how we're going to bury six family members all at once." As it would soon be uncovered, Masak and Garlene had a history of domestic violence. The couple had been married for 2 years, but had been together for around 10 years. Over the course of those 10 years, police were called out to the home for domestic disturbances. In the January before the murders, Masak was arrested on a battery charge, after he was accused of hitting Garlene and causing her to drop Morgan, who was in her arms. This wasn't the first run-in that the couple had had with law enforcement. In June of 2005, Garlene applied for a restraining order against Masak, and said that he would beat her, sexually assault her, and had stolen money from her. In the application she wrote, "He always hit me. He abuses me all the time." A day later, the application was granted and a judge issued Garlene a temporary restraining order. The following day, Masak unsuccessfully sought one against Garlene, claiming that she had cut herself and then blamed him for it. He wrote, "She always says that she will do anything to put me away." He claimed that Garlene had threatened to take the children away from him and then move back in with her mother in Haiti. He said that she threatened to kill him and had said that her brother owned 2 guns. A week later, Masak's case was dropped due to lack of evidence. A clerk wrote that Masak had admitted that he had filed the papers as a defensive move against Garlene. Just the following week, Masak filed a motion to dismiss. He wrote, "I love her so much. She did a mistake. She brought me here and charged me with domestic violence." He cited their years together and said that they planned on getting married. In November of 2006, however, Masak sought a restraining order against Garlene. In the application, he said that Garlene wasn't patient, that she had a temper, and that she harmed the children. By this point in time, Masak had a new girlfriend, and he wanted Gerline to stay away from him, and stay away from his place of employment. He wrote that it was Gerline who had ended the relationship, and asked him to leave, but now he wanted a restraining order. The following month, Judge Frank Baker denied Misak's application. He had failed to even show up at court, although Gerline had showed up. Just 3 months later, however, in March of 2007, Gerline and Misak applied for a marriage license, and just 3 weeks later, they were married at the First Haitian Baptist Church in Naples. Things for the couple were quiet until January of 2009, when Gerline called 911 to report that Misak had punched her in the face several times, ripped her shirt off, and then choked her. Gerline had been holding Morgan when the attack unfolded, and she accidentally dropped her as she was attacked. Morgan had fallen 4 feet to the concrete floor, and then Misak had stolen Gerline's phone. She couldn't call 911 until he left the house. When police arrived at the scene, the children corroborated Gerline's version of events, with Maven telling police, "Daddy was hitting Mommy." The ordeal had understandably terrified the children, and in interviews they said that they were afraid of their father, and that he hit their mother weekly. Misak told the caseworker that when his father would abuse his mother, he would try and take all of the children to a bedroom, but when he tried to call 911, Misak would hit him on the hand or on the head. A DCF investigative summary at the time assessed that the overall risk in the home was high. According to the report, Gerline said that Misak had grown up watching domestic violence in the home, and she believed that this was the reason he thought that his behaviour was okay. Police documented Gerline's injuries and Misak was arrested. However, Gerline would later recant her account twice. Misak pleaded no contest and was given 12 months probation and ordered to attend parenting classes, as well as a battery intervention programme. According to reports, Misak was making steady progress after working with the Children's Network, as well as parenting classes and domestic violence classes. Misak had told caseworkers that he enjoyed taking the classes because they were helping him with methods to better control his anger and his emotions. Misak had also been handed a no-contact order and was not allowed to live with the family. During this time, Gerline began counselling at a shelter for abused women. However, Gerline was overwhelmed by being a single mother and requested that the no-contact order be lifted. From a visit in late March, a caseworker wrote, "She believes that a father should be with his children, and she has faith in him, that he will not repeat domestic violence against his wife." In April, that no-contact order was lifted, and Gerline said to the caseworker that it was so nice for Misak to be back home with her and the children. She said that Misak was respecting her more. In addition to the classes that Misak was taking, the family participated in an 8-week program, wherein they worked with a master's level clinician in their home. The clinician worked with them twice a week for the first 4 weeks, and then once a week after that. Over the years, family members and friends of Gerline often urged her to leave her husband. The abuse was so bad that on one occasion, Gerline would sleep in her car. Her friend, Marie Amy, spoke with the Naples Daily News and said that they had always said to her, "Gerline, if he tried to kill you, just leave him. Don't let him kill you." Marie and Gerline had met when they both worked in Publix, and she said that Gerline had a beautiful life, that all of her problems involved Misak. Gerline was an extremely caring person and an amazing mother who doted on her children, and she was a friend to all of her colleagues. Her brother Ferenc said that whatever Gerline had, she would give it to her family. She worked very hard to provide her children with the best life possible, and when she wasn't working, she would be spending time with her children, often taking them to parks, to the mall, and to the cinema. She was certainly a woman devoted to her family. Gerline would rise each morning before 5 a.m. to prepare the meals for the day, get the children ready for school, see the boys off to school, and then start her shift at Publix. She also made sure that the home was always clean. Gerline had been born in Haiti and moved to the United States in the mid-1990s, with her brother, McKindy. According to McKindy, when they lived together, Gerlene had become like a second mother to him. She always told her friends that the reason she worked so hard was to provide the best for her children, that she wanted her children to have a good education and become something. The DeMas children were known to be extremely friendly and polite. Neighbors said that they often saw Mitch Sack, Marvin, and Maven at the bus stop each morning, waiting for the bus which would take them to school. Mitch Sack was very protective of his younger siblings, often warning them to stay away from the street. The children often greeted neighbors and could typically be seen playing in their front yard. Mitch Sack was bigger than the rest of the kids in his class, and loved playing football and telling knock-knock jokes. He loved wearing a sideways cap and often visited the classrooms of his two younger brothers to ask their teachers if there was anything he could do at home to help with their education or help with their homework. Marvin loved cartoons and always made sure his homework was complete on time. He looked out for his younger siblings and wanted to set a good example. Marvin was the quiet one of the family, while Maven loved playing with other children and liked to draw. Megan loved to dance and her favourite toy was Barney. Morgan, the youngest of the siblings, was fond of her food. According to McKindy, Gerlene's brother, the children were happy-go-lucky, but they were obviously affected by their father's abuse. He said that when he visited the family in the past or they had visited him, the children would always tell him about their father hitting their mother. Following the murders, Melanie Fike, the assistant principal of Osceola Elementary School, where Mitch Sack, Marvin, and Maven were students, said that they were the three most polite boys ever, and all three were always very happy to be in school and were always smiling. She said that Gerlene was very involved in their education. She always made sure to attend each teacher conference, curriculum nights, and inquired about ways she could help enrich their education at home. On the Wednesday before the murders, a Department of Children and Families caseworker, who had been assigned to the family, had made an unannounced visit, and she reported that the children seemed to be healthy and safe. Misak was at home and dinner was being cooked. Misak had been due to finish a court-ordered battery intervention course in the November, and the caseworker wrote, "There is no safety concern, children are doing fine." Gerlene arrived at the home shortly after the caseworker, Manju Nath, arrived. She also wrote that the home was clean and the family seemed to be on good terms. In the wake of the murder, some questioned whether DCF had failed the family. Administrator Cookie Coleman defended their actions. She said that human behaviour is not predictable, but based on what they saw at the home on the Wednesday, and there was no indication of what was going to unfold. On two separate occasions, Gerlene had requested that a no-contact order against Misak be lifted. Such a decision can happen for a variety of reasons when it comes to domestic abuse. Two main reasons can be fear and economic stability. Sadly, leaving an abuser does not equal safety, and a number of victims find themselves in a situation where they're damned if they do and damned if they don't. In 2008 alone, Florida Department of Law Enforcement statistics showed that there were 180 domestic violence-related homicides. 60 of those were committed by a spouse. Far too often, people question why victims of domestic abuse don't just leave. But sadly, it isn't as simple as packing your bags and walking out. When people enter a relationship with a domestic abuser, they don't realise that they are a domestic abuser. It's once the trust is established that the domestic abuser begins to show signs. There is often a very slow pattern which begins with verbal abuse and then proceeds to systematic isolation before escalating to physical abuse. Domestic abuse is about power and control, and victims can often feel as though they are stuck in a situation from which they cannot escape. Some victims who stay in domestic violent relationships do so because they love their partner and sometimes feel as though they will change. Some victims are too afraid of what will happen if they try to leave. Some victims also feel as though there is no alternative, that they rely too heavily on their partner, whether for financial reasons or for help with children. It can often be a catch-22 situation, wherein a woman does not have the financial ability to leave a situation. Wanting to leave and being able to leave are two very different things. The school would have crisis counsellors on hand for the students at the school, and teachers were briefed on the grim murders as soon as the news broke in the media. Counsellors greeted children at the bus stop in the morning, and counsellors were specifically sent to the classrooms of Mitchsack, Marvin and Maven, who were respectively in the third grade, first grade and kindergarten. A statement was read out about the tragedy in the morning news announcements, following which the school would observe a moment of silence. Do you grind your teeth in your sleep? If so, you're one of the 40 million Americans who do. There are a number of causes such as stress, anxiety, or even an abnormal bite. Grinding your teeth can sadly cause a number of problems, such as worn enamel, tooth decay, sleeplessness, and expensive dental problems. According to dentists, the number one teeth grinding prevention is a custom-fitted night guard. However, these can be very costly, with the average dentist charging around $200 to $300 per night guard, and you can grind through several of those a year. That's where today's sponsor, Smile Brilliant, comes in. Smile Brilliant uses a lab direct process to bring you the same custom fitted night guard, but for as little as $45 per night guard. In addition, they also have custom fitted whitening trays and the Carry Pro electronic toothbrush. For me personally, taking care of my teeth is of utmost importance, and Smile Brilliant make it straightforward and affordable. Just head on over to smilebrilliant.com and use the promo code MORBIDOLOGY to check out for 30% off. Once again, that's smilebrilliant.com and use code MORBIDOLOGY for 30% off your order. Is there something interfering with your happiness, or are you apprehensive about reaching out for help? BetterHelp is here to help you, and they're today's sponsor of Morbidology. BetterHelp is not self-help, it's professional counselling available to you online or over the phone. BetterHelp is more affordable and accessible than traditional offline counselling, and they offer financial aid. Sadly, sometimes traditional offline counselling is not locally available for everybody, but BetterHelp is available for clients worldwide. They have licensed professional counsellors specialising in a broad variety of areas, including depression, sleeping, self-esteem, grief, and much more. Everything you share with your counsellor is confidential and they are matched to your specific needs. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/morbidology. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/morbidology. Just the day after the murders were announced in the media, it was announced that Mitchsack had been arrested near the airport in Haiti. Girlene's family, who were also from Haiti, had put up a $10,000 reward for information regarding his whereabouts. He had been found hiding in a house next door to a motel, located around 5 miles from Girlene's mother's home, when he was apprehended by a motorcycle unit of the National Police. When he was arrested, he had told police that he planned on surrendering and had only come to Haiti to say goodbye to his family. He reportedly said, "I was going to turn myself in. You see, I've got my suit on and everything." According to investigators, however, they didn't believe that Mitchsack was ever going to hand himself in, stating he missed an awful lot of opportunities to turn himself in. Following his arrest, investigators were going to be working with federal officials to apply the appropriate internal extradition proceedings. However, since Mitchsack hadn't yet been charged with the murders, they issued an arrest warrant for him for violating probation on the January arrest for domestic violence. Just the following day, however, Mitchsack was charged with 6 counts of first-degree murder. Haitian authorities had two ways in which they could proceed with extradition, either through the normal extradition process, under a treaty in place between two countries since 1904, or by deporting Missak. They would follow the normal extradition process, and Missak would be extradited straight away. As he was being led out of the jail he was being held in Haiti, he briefly spoke with a reporter from Naples Daily News.
Okay. Mr. Damas, anything you want to say?
Yes. I want to be buried with my family. That's what I want to do.
Did you kill them?
Yes, I did.
Why?
Only God knows.
You don't know?
No, I don't.
Mr. Damas, do you want to be sentenced to death or do you want life in prison?
Death. I want death. Right away, because I think my family probably buried this Saturday coming up. I want the jury to give me death right now that I can bury with them same time.
Why? Why did you do it? What possessed you to do it?
Her mom pretty much made me do it.
Why? In what way?
Her mom, devil, her mom, spirit, whatever she's serving, whatever she's worshiping.
Why in such a brutal way? Why children? Your children. What did they do?
They don't do nothing. They're innocent. Everybody's innocent.
Then why? Why would you kill them if they're innocent?
Devil exists. You believe in Jesus Christ? Do you believe in Jesus?
Do you believe in Jesus Christ?
Do you believe in Jesus?
Do you believe? Do you believe in the devil?
I believe in Jesus Christ. When I did it, my eyes was closed. Now right now, my eyes open.
Are you gonna go to heaven when you die?
Right now, yeah. Right now. But if I kill myself, I was gonna kill myself. But I didn't have the courage to do it, because if you kill yourself, you're not going to heaven.
When were you going to kill yourself?
The same time that happened. You know, but I didn't have the time. I didn't have the courage to do it myself.
So why'd you come back?
Come back where?
To Haiti.
To say bad to my family. I'm the one who was going to turn myself in. Just let you know.
Missak was placed in a police car to take him to the airport. And he continued to speak to the media from here. He said that he had planned on killing himself, but lacked the courage. He feared that if he took his own life, he wouldn't get into heaven. He also blamed Gerline's mother, as well as an evil spirit, for causing the murders, and said that he had found forgiveness through Christianity. According to Lewis Wilkins, a Haitian police officer, Missak had spoken to him about the murders and had told him that Gerline had been unfaithful. While in Haiti, Missak had stayed at a home, which had been rented by his cousin. He met with the homeowner and spoke really cryptically about his home life back in Florida and why he was in Haiti. He told the homeowner that he loved his family, but said he had done something bad back at home. He said that his children weren't well and that he fervently read his Bible. The homeowner, Fadia Morency, said that she had noticed that both of his hands were scratched and his fingers had deep cuts. According to Missak's cousin, who had rented the house, Missak had told him that back in Florida, he had gotten into a fight with Gerline and left her unconscious on the floor. He claimed that he had punched Gerline and then left the children at home alone. The cousin claimed that family in the United States had not called them to inform them that in fact, Gerline and the children had been murdered. Upon arriving back in Florida, Missak was sent to the Collier County Jail, where he was ordered to be held without bond. He had been placed in the jail's medical unit to protect both himself and others, given the nature of the crime he was accused of. People who kill children and women are very low in the prison hierarchy. He failed to appear at the first court hearing, where the judge appointed him Deputy Public Defender Michael Orlando. Judge Frank Baker ordered that Missak undergo a psychological examination to determine whether he was competent to stand trial. According to Defense Orlando, he believed that his client was insane at the time of the murders. Meanwhile, the area outside the Damas home had become a memorial. Arranged between two palm trees near the front door, locals left balloons, flowers and stuffed animals as a symbol of condolences. The public where Gerline had been employed also set up a memorial for the family and a container for cash donations at the customer service desk. It consisted of two framed photographs of the family, a cross, red roses, two candles and cards. There's a piece of paper which read, "In loving memory of Garlene Damas and her 5 beautiful children." The Shelter for Abused Women and Children would hold a candlelight vigil just days after Miss Sack was extradited back to the United States. 6 white roses were placed on 6 empty chairs for each of the victims, while a single red rose was placed on another chair to symbolize all victims and survivors of domestic violence. Linda Oberhaus said to the crowd, "Today is a day to remember all victims, to commemorate all survivors, and to focus our intentions on the future of our community. A future free of domestic violence." Around 100 people attended the ceremony, including the police officers who had been working on the case. Naples Police Chief Tom Weschler said to the crowd that domestic violence knows no boundaries, and said that many incidents can go unreported for years, and some go unreported forever. He said that the agency had a new strategy for dealing with domestic violence. He said that they were continuing with their zero-tolerance policy towards domestic violence, but they were now developing stronger information and awareness plan with the shelter, and were expanding their newly implemented Intimate Violence Enhanced Service team. He said that by December they would have a new domestic violence liaison program, which would be consisting of specially trained deputies who could respond quickly to any domestic violence case in the county. There would be a special training curriculum in place, and they would also be implementing a domestic violence assessment form, which all deputies must use when responding to domestic-related incidents. He said that this would help the sheriff's office better identify and track potentially volatile cases. Just the day after the vigil, Defence Orlando filed a plea of not guilty on behalf of Miss Sack. On the 3rd of October, Garlene and the children were laid to rest. Their funeral was held at the First Haitian Baptist Church of Naples. All of Garlene's family wore white as they sat at the front of the church. There was a section further back, reserved for Miss Sack's family. Many burst into sobs of tears and screamed as 4 white coffins were brought into the church. This was the traditional way of Haitian mourning. There were 6 victims, but Megan and Morgan were buried in the caskets of Marvin and Maven, respectively. Around 2,000 people had packed into the church for the service. A number of people in attendance did not know the family, but wanted to come and pay their final respects. A lot of those in attendance were Haitian and felt a cultural bond to the victims. As Reynold Casimir said, "It's something that's never happened in the Haitian community." Between each coffin was a poster board depicting the lives of Garlene, Mitch Sack, Marvin, Maven, Megan, and Morgan. Classmates of the 3 oldest children were also in attendance. Their classmates had written letters to their friends following their deaths. In one, a friend drew a picture that he knew Mitch Sack would love. Slideshows played on several screens. The 3-hour service was conducted in English, French, and Creole. The service was led by Reverend Jean Paul, and he was joined by several other pastors on the stage. He said that God had not abandoned the family, but instead, they were collateral damage in the larger battle between good and evil. Much of the service focused on fond memories. Nieces, nephews, and cousins of the victims gathered on stage to reminisce about the good times. Maven was remembered as mischievous, while Marvin was said to have a sweet nature. 2 young nephews of Garlene sang a song in her memory. Masak was very rarely mentioned, but when he was, it was only in relation to happy memories of his family. Following the service, the family were buried at Palm Royale Cemetery and Mausoleum. Hundreds of people gathered around the gravesite. They sang hymns and watched as family members released doves into the air. The funeral was paid for in full through the Florida Attorney General's Office's Crime Victim Compensation Program. The money in this program comes from when a defendant is sentenced. There is a $50 fee that is imposed, and part of that fee goes into a trust fund. The program was established back in 1978. And the purpose was to provide fair treatment for victims and witnesses. The program funded a variety of expenses, including domestic violence relocation assistance, prosthetic devices, mental health counseling, prescriptions and property loss. A local florist and limousine service also provided their services for free. The family barely had any time to mourn before gruesome details of the crime were made public. Just the day after the funeral, 3 search warrants related to the murders were released. While the family obviously had an idea of how the victims had died, they didn't know the extent of the injuries until the search warrants were released. The warrants also revealed that blood had been found inside Misak's SUV, which had been collected for testing. It also revealed that a box cutter had been found at the crime scene, as well as an empty knife sheath. Investigators had also recovered a voicemail from Misak from the morning he fled to Haiti. He had called his father Gene and cried that his family needed to be strong. He said that he had been in a fight with his wife and that he had hit her and didn't believe that she was going to wake up. Even more disturbing details would be released the following day. Misak told a US official while in Haiti that he had bound Garlene and covered her mouth with duct tape. She had pleaded to speak with him. He said that when he momentarily took the duct tape off her mouth, she told him that she loved him and begged him not to hurt their children. He said he had second thoughts before realizing that if he let her go, she would call the police and the children would be taken away. He said that his rage had begun when Garlene told him on 2 different occasions that she was leaving him and was going to take the children with her. He said that he told her, "Only death will separate us. Only death." He left his shift at Miller's Ale House early on the Thursday, and when he got home, Garlene had asked him to sign immigration papers. Misak said he had become furious, grabbed a knife and some rope, and tied her up. He said that he contemplated a number of scenarios, including killing the children in front of Garlene and burning the house down with him and the children inside. He also said that he considered sparing the children, but then realized that the custody of his children would probably go to Garlene's mother, who he said that he hated. In early December, prosecutors announced that they would be seeking the death penalty against Misak. According to Florida law, aggravating factors included acts that are heinous, atrocious, and cruel, and acts that are cold, calculated, and premeditated, as well as acts wherein the victim is under the age of 12, and those in which the offender is the parent of the victim. Moreover, under Florida law, each individual murder counts as a prior felony to the next. It was pretty much a given that Misak would be facing the death penalty. One of the mitigating factors his defense would likely use would be trying to claim that Misak was insane when he committed the murders. As I've mentioned in a lot of episodes of Morbidology, insanity is an extremely difficult standard to meet. In May of the following year, Defense Orlando announced that he was leaving the agency to open up his own private business in Fort Lauderdale. He said that he'd be handing his cases over to his successors, including Misak's case. This also meant that the case would be pushed back. His new defense team was led by public defender Kathleen Fitzgeorge and was assisted by Neil McLaughlin and Connie Kelly. Meanwhile, Marvin, Maven, and Metchsack were remembered during a memorial at Osceola Elementary School. Portraits of the 3 boys were etched into a memorial bench in the flower garden by the school's front gate. Teachers, students, and family members gathered, as Principal Jody Jordan said, "We hope it gives your family comfort to know how much they were loved at Osceola and how much they loved school." Local schools and businesses had collected more than $5,000 for the memorial bench, which cost around $4,000. The remainder went to the family. A couple of months later, Misak was in court for a brief status hearing. He had lost a significant amount of weight and was wheeled into the courtroom in a restrained chair.
There will be a day I'm going to see my Lord.
Whatever happens, Romita, when God knows everything about us.
Misak sang a Christian hymn loudly, and told Judge Franklin Baker he was angry that he was forced to wear orange overalls. He said that he had preferred to wear a jail-issued padded jacket. He stated, "If they're going to treat me like an animal, I'm going to come up like an animal." He said to the judge that he wanted to join his family in heaven, and said that he was ready to be executed. He said he didn't want to wait any longer, and that a year had already passed since the murders. He stated, "Whoever's in charge of this, make the call. Whoever can make the decision, throw the switch." Following the brief appearance, Misak spoke with his father, Gene, on the phone from jail. He lectured his father on religion and his interpretation of the Bible. He said that he had read the Bible around 15 times since his arrest the previous year. He claimed that he loved his wife and children, and said that he could not live without them. He said that witches had been trying to eat him, and he spoke about a big butterfly that dropped a bunch of stuff on him. He said to his father, "I told God, ever since I married my wife, I don't want to get involved with other women anymore. I don't want to give anyone any troubles anymore. But I did not keep my promise. I left the church and I started to do bad things. Adultery is a big thing." He ended the phone call with one final request: a photograph of Gerlene and the children. Early the following year, Misak appeared in court and told Judge Frank Baker that he wanted to represent himself, stating, "It's me and the Lord. That's it. No one else."
"Mr. Judge, can I say something? I'd like to represent myself, please. I'm 34 years old. And I have the right to represent myself. Is that okay?"
Mr. DeMoss, can I at least, I will listen to that argument, your position."
"No, I'd like to represent myself."
I heard what you said.
"One of my lawyers who represented because me and my lawyer is just enough, my brother and my sister. We mean what God says. Do not judge, you shall not be judged. God won't judge you. I mean, that's the word of God. Matthew 7, verse 22. So therefore, I think I have the right to the United States. And I got no more lawyers. I don't need no more lawyers. But I would appreciate you guys representing me. And I love that. You know what I'm saying? God bless you and everything. Now, it's not up to you right now. It's up to me and the Lord."
"Give me a second, sir, all right? Listen, please. I've listened to what you had to say, and you have the right to ask me to let you do that.
Yes.
I'm not going to rule on that today. I want to tell you why. I need one more report that I have to see. But once I get this report, I can ask you some questions if you'll stay focused with me when I ask them. And based on the answers you give me, I can make a decision if legally I can let you represent yourself as requested, all right? So if you'll give me some time to get there, I promise you we'll get there." "Thank you for telling me that.
For those who have Jesus Christ in your life, please, find a good church. Give your life to Jesus. My brother, please don't touch me, my brother. Jesus is coming. You say that. Read the book of Revelation, the book of prophecy.
Mr. DeMoss, if you want me to listen,
Daniel,
you want me to listen.
Mr. DeMoss,
if you want me to listen to you, you got to listen to me, okay?"
He had been in a courtroom filled with other people who were waiting for their cases to be called. At one point, he turned around and urged the people to find a good church and to give their lives to Jesus. The judge said that Misak had received two competency evaluations, and that they had offered differing opinions. The judge said he would be appointing a third competency evaluation. Another hearing would follow just days later to discuss the competency hearings, and during this hearing, Misak ignored the protests of the judge and spoke directly into TV cameras. He said, "Don't cry for me, guys. Cry for yourself." He said that he needed a place in heaven and a place on death row, so that he could preach the word of God. The judge was set a May hearing to determine the competence of Misak. However, when May rolled around, the judge would postpone the competency hearing until June. During the hearing, it would be revealed that two out of the three psychologists determined that Misak was competent to stand trial. All three psychologists said that when they spoke to Misak, he refused to speak about the murders, but instead wanted to preach with the same religious fervour he'd shown in court. All three of the psychologists regarded this as Misak's way of avoiding speaking about the murders. Both Michael Herkov and Frederick Schaff testified that Misak was competent and could assist in his own defence. Robert Silver, however, testified that Misak suffered from a delusional disorder and was incompetent. he stated, in Mr. Damas's case, he believes he no longer has to take heed of the material world. In other words, he feels he's immune to man's law, and only responsible to God's law. Dr. Harkov and Dr. Schaaf said that they had interviewed staff at the jail about Misak's behaviour. They said that he preached to visitors such as doctors, but when they left, he became calm and spoke about regular things, such as his diet and his desire to see his family. The judge would ultimately decide that Misak was competent to stand trial. 2 weeks later, Misak was back in court, this time to challenge the competency of his public defenders. Once again, Misak announced that he wanted to represent himself. Obviously, the Constitution grants defendants the right to self-representation, although a defendant cannot use a lack of legal counsel as basis for an appeal. Just the year before the murders, the US Supreme Court ruled that a judge could deny this right to defendants who still suffer from severe mental illness, to the point where they are not competent to conduct trial proceedings on their own. Judge Franklin Baker would turn down Misak's request and said that he was not even close to being confident that Misak understood the seriousness of his request. He was ordered to stand trial for the murders in 2014. In October of 2013, Misak was back in court for the first time in quite a while for a case management conference. He was once again wheeled in his restrained chair, but this time he was completely non-responsive. He lay back with his eyes closed. It was a stark difference to his behaviour during his earlier court hearings. Shortly after Misak returned to jail following this hearing, he was involved in a jailhouse scuffle. He was accused by fellow inmates of attacking them in their housing area. Camera footage from inside the jail cell captured Misak punching 2 inmates, and then 3 other inmates became involved in the scuffle. All of the inmates, except for 1, were taken for medical assistance. As the trial was fast approaching, in January of 2014, Misak spoke with the Daily News. He claimed that he was a changed man and that he had been possessed by demons at the time of the murders. He described himself as a new creature in Christ and even compared himself to the Apostle Paul, who persecuted early Christians before he was converted. He said, "Just like Paul was a murderer but became saved and preached the gospel all over the world, I, who under the influence of the enemy, did the same thing, but am now saved, and now preach the gospel all over this jail." He claimed that the murders were an out-of-body experience. He said that at first he considered an insanity defense, but decided against it, stating that it would be dishonest. He spoke about his life before the murder, stating that he had everything a young Haitian immigrant could ever want. A good job, a nice home, 5 wonderful children, a beautiful wife, and a couple of girlfriends on the side. He said he was not proud of that sinful life, but for a sinner like him, it was a really good life. He also said that he missed his family and thought about them all the time. He spoke about Gerline's family and said he hoped that they did not hate him, stating, "I am so sorry for their loss, knowing also I lost the most precious gift that God has given me in this world. The Bible tells me a good wife is more than a treasure, so be encouraged, do not hate me." He expressed regret for his actions, but he stopped short of offering up a genuine apology. A couple of months before the trial was expected to begin, it was announced that Misak had been found incompetent to stand trial. The evaluation had been by the 2 psychiatrists who had earlier found Misak competent. This meant that Misak would be committed to a state mental health treatment facility, and his prosecution would resume whenever he was declared competent. Judge Ramiro Manalik wrote that Misak suffered from a major mental illness that had rendered him incompetent. Misak would spend less than a month in the state mental health treatment facility before he was ruled competent to stand trial once again. However, upon returning to jail, Misak's competency was once again brought to question. He rejected his legal name and refused to shower for several weeks. According to deputies in the jail, the smell was so bad that it was causing other inmates to vomit. The smell was urine coming from Misak's jail cell. He informed deputies that his name was not Misak, but it was C-O-G, standing for Child of God. Misak would announce that he wanted to change his not guilty plea to guilty, and asserted that he was competent and in his right state of mind. He would be ordered to face another competency hearing, and once again, he would be ruled competent to stand trial. With the setbacks, it was expected that Misak would be facing trial in 2015. Early the following year, however, Misak's defence lawyers requested to be removed from the case, citing a conflict of interest.
It's our office policy to investigate conflicts. And I had my homicide chief do a full investigation. Every client is entitled to conflict-free counsel. And so once we had a conflict, we had to get off the case. When the public defender has a conflict, it goes to us. If we have a conflict, it goes to private counsel.
Two private attorneys, Kevin Shirley and James R. McCora, were appointed. It was then announced that a November trial date had been tentatively set for the case to finally go to trial. However, in September, Judge Fred Hart indefinitely delayed the case. He ruled that the trial should wait until the U.S. Supreme Court decided whether Florida's death penalty procedures were constitutional. The U.S. Supreme Court were debating whether jurors or a judge should be responsible for finding certain aggravating factors exist to warrant a death sentence. While the trial was postponed, the defense and the prosecution were still working around the clock on the case. In early February, they were in court to argue about the admissibility of autopsy photographs in trial. 79 graphic photographs were shown in the courtroom. As the photographs were shown, Misak refused to look at them. At one point, he even said, "How much longer is this going to take? I've got to get back and take a nap. I'm uncomfortable." Ultimately, the judge would agree that 60 of the 79 photographs could be entered as evidence. Then just the following month, the Florida House passed a bill to overhaul the state's death penalty law. This meant that going forward, at least 10 out of 12 jurors needed to recommend a death sentence for it to be carried out. The trial was once again rescheduled, this time for September of 2017. Misak appeared in court in mid-July for a pre-trial hearing. Misak was once again uncooperative during the hearing. He ignored the judge's questions and instead went on a rambling speech. He said that he wanted to receive a death sentence for the murders, stating, "The state's trying to kill me, right? They're trying to prove that I'm guilty of this charge. That is their job, right? Okay, I'll make it easier for the state. Okay, I'm guilty of this charge. Let my plea be received right now."
I want this thing to be done as soon as possible. You know, I don't want a trial, and then especially I don't want my family to be involved in this.
What do you want to be sentenced to? Death?
Yeah, just death.
You want to be sentenced to death?
Enough is enough. I don't want my people to keep trying, crying, you know, when they hear about this case, every time they, you know, they see it on TV.
Judge Fred Hart explained to Misak that pleading guilty wasn't that simple. And once again, Misak was ordered to undergo a competency evaluation. Misak would be ruled competent, and in August, he was given the opportunity to plead guilty to the murders. Misak sat with his head down and refused to speak. He had been so adamant that he wanted to plead guilty, but when given the opportunity, he didn't take it. The judge ordered that the September murder trial go ahead. On what would have been the first day of jury selection, Misak appeared in court and he finally pleaded guilty to all six of the murders. The plea was accepted by Judge Christian Greeter. She had been assigned to the case after Judge Fred Hart recused himself. Misak was given the opportunity to speak, and he finally offered an apology. He said, "I just want to say I'm truly sorry, especially to the family of my wife. I don't see them here today, but I just want to make sure for the record that they know that. I know how much they love their sister, their daughter, their grandchildren. And then I want to make sure that everyone knows that I love them the most. I love my people, my wife and children. But this thing happened. I don't have an answer for it. I wish I had an answer for it, but I don't. When I stand before the great God, I will ask him a lot of questions. From now on, I'm just going to put my trust in him and say sorry to the whole world. It was now time for the sentencing phase. Isaac would be facing either a life sentence without parole or a death sentence. The prosecution and defence would need to present mitigating and aggravating factors. His defence would try and save his life by presenting evidence that he was mentally ill and had been raised in a violent and paranoid culture in Haiti by a family who were marked by religious tension. Dr. Mark Rubino, a neurologist, was called by the defence. He testified that he had analysed MRI and positron emission tomography scans of Misak's brain and said it showed abnormalities, including enlarged ventricles and atrophied temporal lobes. He said he believed that Misak had suffered from schizophrenia. Under cross-examination, Assistant State Attorney Rich Montecalvo attempted to poke holes in his testimony. He noted that his qualifications were as a neurologist rather than a neuropsychologist, and questioned the accuracy of the brain scans. He pointed out that other doctors had found no evidence of mental illness. The defence then called on Elizabeth McAllister, a professor and specialist in Afro-Caribbean religions, to testify. She testified that while growing up, Misak's family had mixed evangelical Christianity and voodoo in the household. She said that Misak had spoken about black magic and being under a demonic attack at the time of the murders. She said that Misak believed that Gerline's mother had put a curse or hex on him before he committed the murders. The prosecution then called medical examiner Manfred Borgs to testify about the autopsies and crime scene photographs. He testified that many of the victims had attempted to defend themselves against the attack, which had been committed with a fillet knife Misak had purchased from Walmart. He said that Misak had slit their throats several times in a bid to finally kill them. He said that there was an evident struggle inside the home. Jessica Gerster, a crime scene investigator, showed the courtroom the murder weapon. It had been found in one of the bedrooms and had been bent during the vicious attack. Family members of Gerline and the children provided emotional victim impact statements. McKindy, the brother of Gerline, described his sister as a doting mother and hard worker. He said that Mitchsack wanted to be a professional footballer, while Marvin and Maven wanted to be wrestlers. He said that Megan and Morgan were still so young that their opportunities in life had been limitless. They could have changed the world and could have been anything they dreamed of. He described standing outside the family's home in the pouring rain, as the crime scene inside was just being discovered by responding officers. He said that as soon as the police officer walked outside and he saw the look of sheer terror on his face, he knew then and there what had happened. He knew that his sister and his nephews and nieces were all dead, inside, without the officer having to say a single word. He said that he was left an empty shell of a man, standing in his sister's driveway in the pouring rain. Speaking of his nieces and nephews, he said, "They will never graduate. They will never go to prom. They will never drive a car, get married, or become mothers, fathers, aunts and uncles." In closing arguments, Chief Assistant State Attorney Amira Fox laid out the evidence against Misak and listed the aggravating factors, including that the murders were heinous and atrocious, as well as cold, calculated and premeditated.
The heinous, atrocious and cruel quality, the cold, calculated and premeditated quality, which made this case the exact type of case that was contemplated when Florida decided to have a death penalty.
During her statement, Misak stuffed tissue inside his ears. She read out part of Misak's own statement, in which he detailed methodically killing his entire family. He wrote that he had paused before killing Mitchsack, his oldest son, and Morgan, his youngest daughter, and had considered letting them live. He wrote, "Then the voice said, 'You've got two more left. You're going to die anyway. You're going to leave those two behind? Her mom will probably have custody of them.' I said, 'Hell no, I don't want to give her mom custody.' And then I went upstairs and cut the little one." State Attorney Fox requested that the court impose a sentence of death. In closing arguments of the defense, they questioned whether the murders of the children were premeditated, and argued that Misak was not thinking clearly at the time of the murders. They said that Misak had a brain abnormality and a history of mental illness. Defense Irma Korma said, "Mr. Damas, throughout the proceedings, has exhibited bizarre behavior, and you almost don't need to be an expert to realize that there must be something wrong." He requested that Misak be sentenced to life in prison. Ultimately, the judge would hand down a sentence of 6 counts of death, one for each family member that Misak murdered. As the verdict was handed down, Gerline's family quietly hugged one another. In a post-hearing press conference, McKinney said, "The emotional roller coaster is over. It's finally time for the Dew Angels to rest in peace." He asked the public to honour his family members by remembering who they were: a strong and resilient mother and 5 children who had their whole lives ahead of them.
"The whole emotional roller coaster is over. It is finally time for the Dew Angels to rest in peace. Choose to remember our family for what it was and always will be: a family of love, a family of strength, a family of honor."
The murder of Gerline, Mitchsack, Marvin, Maven, Megan, and Morgan was the most horrific crime that Southwest Florida had seen in modern day history. Misak Damas manipulated the justice system for almost a decade, just like he had manipulated his family for more than a decade. In the space of just mere minutes, Misak had wiped out an entire generation. An entire generation that he had helped to create. He should have been the protector of his wife and his children. His wife and children who absolutely doted on him, despite the fact that he had made their lives a living hell. In the end, Misak has been left with nothing but his own memories of what he has done. He will remain in a 6x9-foot cell, with no air condition for 23 hours a day, until that fateful day that he is strapped to a gurney and pumped with the drugs that will finally end his life. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporters, Ree, Tony, and Hannah. As you all know, Morbidology is a one-woman team, and the support on Patreon seriously goes such a long way. In return for your support on Patreon, you get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular podcast platform. Morbidology merch, including t-shirts, stickers, pins, badges, and fridge magnets. You can also get ad-free and early release episodes, and you can request a case for me to cover on the podcast. You can join for as little as $1 a month, and there are absolutely no obligations. You can cancel any time. If you sign up annually, you also get 15% off. Can I also ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. If you're feeling extra generous, you can even leave a written review. Ratings and reviews are an easy way to support a show that you like, and reading the reviews seriously makes my day. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo of the amazing true crime podcast, Red Rum. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Clarissa frantically called 911 and told the operator that she was 36 weeks pregnant and had just given birth at home, but the baby wasn't breathing and had turned blue. Paramedics quickly arrived and took Clarissa and baby Xander to the hospital, where he was rushed to intensive care. Hospital staff noticed that Clarissa's arms, hands and face were covered in blood, assumedly from the home delivery. But when they managed to check Clarissa over, they made the chilling discovery that she showed no signs at all of having given birth. Red Rum is a podcast focusing on the true victims of crime. Search Red Rum True Crime wherever you get your podcasts.